Hello, and welcome to another episode of Tactical Startup. My name is Taylor Darcy, where I help small businesses like yourself have the business of your dreams. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited. In fact, Seth and I have worked very hard to get together. We've had babies being born, family events occurring, emergencies occurring, and so it has been a little bit of a challenge to get him on here, but I'm so excited because I've followed him on his live streams that he does, as well as with Jay Ruane, which hopefully I can get him on here sometime. But I digress. So I'm very excited to have him on here. Let me just tell you a little bit about Seth. He's an accomplished attorney and transformational thought leader. Seth is a founding partner and the business backbone of Price Benowitz LLP, as well as the founder and CEO of Blue Shark Digital. Seth took a two-person law firm and scaled to 40 lawyers in less than a decade. Now Seth has taken the same digital power that built the firm to create a best-in-class digital agency focused on the legal sector in Blue Shark Digital. Seth has been a frequent lecturer and moderator at some of the largest and most influential law conferences in the United States, speaking on the tools and strategies law firms can use to align their business development with changing consumer habits. He has spoken on topics including, but not limited to, how to build a firm, ethics, best practices for firm operations, search engine optimization, SEO, and digital marketing as a whole. You're listening to Tactical Startup, a podcast dedicated to building amazing businesses. I am your host, Taylor Darcy. In this podcast, we explore ways to innovate, improve, and level up your business through sales, marketing, automation, and business planning. Successful businesses pivot when times are bad and stay the course when times are good. We'll have guests from different walks of life to help you see that success is not only possible, but even probable, no matter when or where you start. Through hard work and strategic planning, you can have the entrepreneurial life you've always dreamed. Tune in weekly to level up your business.
Welcome, Seth.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Now, I have to begin because I wanted to tell the audience a little bit more about you. In fact, a couple of years ago, I talked with you briefly about wanting to take my law firm to the next level. And the thing that you spent a good portion of your time, which I greatly appreciated, talking to me, but more importantly, you didn't talk me into signing up with your service, which earned my great respect because there are a lot of people out there that are only willing to give you their time if you are willing to sign up with their company. And more importantly, that's generally how they steer the conversation. And so when you were so willing to share with me, and then on top of that say, no, now is not the right time for your money, it really meant a lot to me, actually. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on here, was because I felt something, a genuineness that you don't get a lot of times with a lot of entrepreneurs, right? Like they're always looking to sell you on something. And it gets so old being that type of in that environment where every contact you make, like you get 30 emails a day of people trying to sell me on something. And so I wanted you to know that first and foremost, how much that meant to me. And also I wanted my listeners to know that you are a genuine good person that looks for the best of your clients and not just try to get a buck out of them. So thank you so much for that.
No, whenever somebody goes down that road, I had a conversation with you. You never know how it's going to go, but that's honored and touched and hope the advice that I gave was advice that worked well.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, I'm growing my firm. I've got one employee at this moment, and I'm working on developing and pushing forward and getting more and trying to do delegate as much as possible so that I can take me out of it and bring on, you know, take my business to the next level. So
that's awesome.
I wanted to, I guess, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on here is because you have done so many things. And law is an especially difficult sector because of our rules of professional conduct, restrictions on advertising, that just don't exist for most people in business, right? Like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but we just have a tighter restriction on things. How do you juggle all of that? Like, when you're talking with somebody and trying to help them build a law firm or a business in general, how do you juggle all of those different rules of professional conduct and like strategies?
Look, it is a great question. And what I would say is I was particularly fortunate in that I had a law and business partner, same person, who I went to college and law school with, David right. Benowitz. So I got out of law school. There were no jobs in 95, so or 94 when I was looking, and jumped at a big firm and paid my dues and checked the box, so to speak. Had a great experience, amazing mentors, but I was thoroughly mediocre. So by 98, when the economy was booming, and I could get to New York, I started a company. I worked with a company called uslaw.com. I was a founding employee there, precursor to LegalZoom and FindLaw. It was WebMD Money, okay. which was trying to replicate for law what they had done at WebMD at the time. And I got the entrepreneurial bug, and I saw what was possible. I had this great run. But sadly, the first dot-com bubble burst in April of 2000. By January of 2001, everything was pretty much gone. It was cleared. And, you know, the few things that made it, like Amazon, the stock was down to six, right. You know, crazy things that we can't even fathom today. So I was very fortunate in building my firm. You know, I had a partner in doing so who loves the law. He loved the courtroom, and essentially was the chief legal officer.
Right.
And so I do think that one of the areas I do see people getting in trouble with is when they're trying to do both. Now, look, ethical laws are out there. And like, I frankly feel like anybody who stares long enough at the accounting of any consumer focused law firm is going to see issues. Like, it's an awful law. If I could be on a soapbox for a minute, to me, I think that things should be done where you can post a bond, which right. ensures that if something, you know, non-intentional happens, that client funds are protected. There's all sorts of, I think, unnecessary pitfalls, necessary in that you don't want to see anybody hurt, but right. unnecessary from the point of view that there are ways to go around it that would allow for, because to a certain extent, you know, what we have done at Price Benowitz and now seen scaled to many of our partners at Blue Shark and the law firms that we help there is what you want to do. And to me, the secret of what we did was mixing great lawyering and great marketing. Because when I entered the space, 15 plus years ago, there were plenty of people that marketed, but generally they were not best in practice on substance. And there were great substantive lawyers who were like one guy in an office, maybe hiring a second employee. Right. And so there was really this dichotomy. So I felt like we were at a forefront of something where we were saying, hey, we can keep great lawyering and scale marketing and merge those two together. And so to me, it's a combination of not pretending. Like, my passion was not in the courtroom. I did it in law school. I did it briefly after, but not meaningfully. Right. And so the idea is, if you want somebody in the courtroom, that has to be their goal. It has to be what they want to do day in and day out. And by getting people to stay in their lane, whether it be a criminal lawyer doing DUIs, or whether it be a white collar lawyer, whether it be a PI lawyer or med mal lawyer, each of these people not dabbling, but really getting great at their craft, and allowing for a firm as it grows to allow them to focus on their craft while having things like marketing, accounting, right. intake taken care of for them so they can do that. And so that, to me, has been the part I've enjoyed most, which is sort of putting those different building blocks together so that we can keep a core group of amazing lawyers that's now over 40 doing what they love and not having to do the stuff they don't love doing.
So it sounds like you're more in a support role position. Like, I mean, if I had to, you know, put a tag
I'd say
on
manage.
It. Yeah, exactly.
I'm in a management position where I am not pretending to have a caseload and go to court and say I'm the best trial lawyer. I'm not. When I get a client on the phone and I'm speaking to them, which happens from time to time, and I'm like, look, I want you in the court. You don't. Mm-hmm. My job is to figure out how to build the team that's going to do this. And that even within that, look, our industry, is fraught with all sorts of issues, mental health issues, alcoholism, you know, all sorts of it. And the idea is to keep a team of people so that the client who comes in gets that awesome personalized expertise that they need to solve their problem. That in itself, and you know, it's funny because I'm on either podcasts or shows and somebody, you know, you're not a lawyer. Like, what is a lawyer? Meaning the lawyer is a bunch of different things. I happen to take one component of it because, look, you in your position have to do everything, right? You have to be the substantive master, the marketing master, the operations person. And so for me, to me, the more that a law firm can segment those pieces out and have people who are driven in each of those areas, the better off it'll be. And I'll give the best analogy I could give was, if you're old enough to remember early stereos. Mm-hmm. So when I was a tween and teen, the ultimate gift was a stereo. And for my generation, it was cassette player, tuner, turntable. Earlier might have been 8-track, later was a DVD player. But to me, the piece that was so special about it is I love that it was all there. And I was fine with it because I'm not a music file. I like music, but I don't need the best sound. But if you want the best sound, if your life is on the line or your security clearance is on the line, or you have one chance to pay for your kids' long-term care because of an accident, do you want a turntable that's built into this thing, or do you want a turntable that's on the side that's the highest quality turntable out there? And if you knew people love music, they'd listen to they'd have a vinyl play once, record it to a cassette tape, and then listen to that cassette tape. And when that wore down, listen to the vinyl one more, you know. So the idea being, if we could get people to be the best possible tuner, the best possible turntable, that is sort of what my goal is in building and growing the firm.
Yeah, I think, and I've spoke with a lot of different entrepreneurs, and they've voiced similar concerns. Which, by the way, I remember having a component stereo system when I was a kid. They were my parents. We would have different things, and what was nice about it is, if one of them broke down, you could then just replace the piece that was broke instead of having to replace the entire device, which is what happens now with pretty much everything integrated and everything. You break your iPhone and you break your iPhone, right? You have to buy a whole brand new iPhone because you broke it, right? Like, there's no, oh, I'm just going to swap out this piece that's not working anymore because it's so integrated. So it has that benefit, but it also, that's a bad thing too, especially when we're talking about growing a business and being an entrepreneur. You need to be able to take people in and out of roles based on need, right? And I think that that's a important part. And we had component, we had a record player, we had a cassette deck.
They were all inside the same box, right?
Well, no, we had the component ones where they would be separate. But separate, now,
right. So the value play. You had it as a family. For my room, I had the one that was in one box.
Right, right.
And that was okay, but everything was considered mediocre of the three.
Right.
So let's say, I'm taking the analogy too far, but let's say everybody wanted to listen to their own radio station. Right. You could buy four tuners. Right. And that's, to me, the idea of scale is you only need one tuner. But if mom and dad want to be in opposite rooms listening to different things, you need a sec. And so being able to scale that, rather than saying, this is my box and it's there and I can't get any more, you are able to theoretically add additional speakers and additional pieces rather than this preformed, this is what you get, like it or not.
Right, right. And I think that that's, you know, we struggle with that. As a legal industry, I feel like that, you know, everybody's expected to be everything to everyone, right? Like, the boss is supposed to be the, not just the boss, but also the case manager, and also, you know, and clients want the top attorney to do it, even if that partner doesn't have anything to say about it, because they're managing, they're not really working in the day-to-day, right?
But, you know, look, there's plus and minus to everything. There's a guy that I know in my market, it's a second generation PI shop. And he does it mostly himself with one assistant, and he knows every client well, and they get referral business, I'm guessing, better on a per rata basis than just about anybody else. So, you know, there are pluses there, but the truth is, he has capacity issues, and if he's out, he's out. And, you know, if he has an issue, personal issue, like that's the firm. There's nothing else.
Right.
So partly, like, I just had this conversation a minute ago on the digital marketing side, right? So part of the reason I had the reaction I had to you probably when you, I don't even remember the conversation specifically, but I know that as a B2B player, small, I say to people, hey, before you go trying something in the SEO space, you should be joining a country club. You should get season tickets to a ball team. You should be identifying the 100 people in your market that can make you money and have a list and get coffees with. I have a podcast and make sure that I have people that can make me money on that podcast. I got hit up by an Indian outsourced agency that put me on their podcast. Mm-hmm. It got me a weak moment. I said, sure, I'm on. And look, they were lovely. They asked me some good questions, but they were there to make their pitch. And you know what? Respect. They did the very fundamental thing. They stroked my ego enough to get me on a podcast such that I gave them time to hear their pitch. And while we didn't do business, I thought it was genius. But going back to the advantage of like a marketing agency for those that it should work for, if you were a right. B2C player and saying, hey, it's me and one associate, but I want to have three associates and I want to get to $3 million, I'd be like, okay, you can network the hell out of it, but you're not going to get there just from joining a country club and just from doing, you know, a BNI or something like that. So now what are you going to do? Well, you're going to market. So literally got off the phone earlier today with a guy who I love, who's very knowledgeable about digital. One of the lawyers I've met who was like a junior me, loves it, had person. That person flamed out, I think sued them. And so like it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't know.
Right.
It's history is written by the victor, but having a person in-house first, the odds that they're going to have all of those components, you're getting a box. Will they know content? Will they know links? Will they know technical? Will they know local? Will they know paid? Will they know LSAs? So is somebody know all of them well, right? First.
Right.
And second, if that box breaks, you're done. And the curve to get somebody else in. So that is so those are areas where by outsourcing, I would argue you get an advantage. And partly it was this, when I started Blue Shark, it was to protect the law firm because I wanted to have best in class content, best in class links and all these different things. And I knew that as an in-house team, I could only get so far.
Right.
But now that I have people who are managers who are, you know, earning six figures and have responsibility or have a career track, they're not going anywhere. And it allows us to build and grow in a way that I couldn't if I just had the box.
Right. Right. And I think that's such a valuable part is, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs look at it as, oh, I'm spending money on something rather than I'm getting the value of time and I'm getting the freedom to scale, right? Like, and sometimes you don't want to scale, right? Maybe there's a capacity issue, which you mentioned previously with your second gen PI firm. But realistically, capacity is a easier problem to solve. Right. When you've got the workflow, when you've got that coming in, solving capacity is especially in today's gig economy and so many options is significantly easier than not having anything come in. Right.
Well, I would challenge you a little bit on that. Look, it's neither are easy. Right. Getting the phone to ring is a challenge. But capacity gig economy is great and it gives you options.
Right.
But high quality, consistent. I just saw a post on one of the Facebook groups that we're both part of. And I think that somebody was, you know, they hired a part-time person and there was an issue of billing their hours. And there was a whole drama and the person quit very quickly.
Yeah.
And I felt for them. And one of the things that I've always struggled with and tried not to do, and again, in your position, the advice I would give you where you are as you're saying, hey, a part-time employee might be great for you. But as you scale, part-time employees are a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
In theory, you could get somebody on mommy track who's well overqualified for the job because you hit their hours. But I find the stability of part-time stuff very tough. Things change, situations change. Like, I don't want somebody who's interested in something or wants to dabble in it. I want somebody where this is their livelihood. Because when it's their livelihood, we're able to, they need us and we need them and it's mutual versus, you know what, I don't feel like doing this anymore. And that's a tough place to be. And I've seen this. We've seen this during with some of the new Gen Zers, post-millennials.
Yeah, Gen Z.
Where we had people, and of the people of late that didn't work out for one reason or another, they ended up in a situation where they, like, I always check this, of people that flame out for whatever reason. Do they get another job ever? Some do. They go off and they do things. But there are many that never, at least according to LinkedIn, find a career path. They never do anything. They go home to their parents' basement. So the thought being, one of the reasons I don't love hiring right out of college is I want to make sure that somebody is willing to work. Can they go to a place, put in work for 40 hours a week and get paid and understand that that's the new normal post-college?
Right.
Versus I'm a person saying, hey, you can't just do anything you want. We want you to be happy and grow and have opportunity, but we need this work done. And that we need people who are willing to trade their time for the money we're paying them versus why are you taking up my time? And so it comes down to, I feel that the gig economy is awesome. And look, the part that is awesome, you could be anywhere in the country, anywhere in the planet. I talk about something that I really wanted to do and didn't really push forward with is I had an opportunity with one of my top deputies to start a company that we were going to start doing outsourcing for international labor in law firms. Their company's doing it, but I wanted to do a training program that really trained people to solve problems in law firms, and then they would parachute in. And one of the things we worked it out, and there were a number of obstacles that they were solvable, but not ones that I wanted to deal with or wanted as part of the operation, and said, you know what, I'm good and let somebody else make a buck doing that. But that I still, for example, I still think there's a huge opportunity. But the point being is that there is huge potential, as you say, with the gig economy, domestically, internationally, and combined. But the thing that I think I think is still always dangerous is when there's a part-time piece when you're looking for stability and scale. Again, you're a solo, you want to add somebody, because for you, you don't need a full-time bookkeeper. You don't need necessarily a full-time marketer, although I'd argue you'd make money if you did. And you probably don't need a full-time administrative person, not another substantive person to work for you.
Right.
Each of those things. And the odds of finding one person who can do all of them well is not good. So that's where the gig economy is freaking awesome.
Right.
But if you're looking for somebody to build and grow with you to be your right-hand person for X, while I love the idea that it's part-time, if it stays and works, that the value of somebody staying with you over time is worth so much. And that statistically, I have found, for as I've tracked it, part-time solutions don't always have longevity. There are exceptions to every rule, and somebody has a person who's 10 hours a week and it's been 10 years. I love that. But generally, those things fizzle out and don't have the long-term staying. It's when you say, hey, you need to make a living and pay the bills. We have a job for you.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, when I'm thinking of gig economy, I'm not thinking, you know, that this is someone that I'm going to necessarily hire long term, you know, but at the same time, it can allow me to get temporary solutions to temporary problems, right?
Like, understood what I'm saying. I'm crazy the other way.
Sure.
Where I'm like, I want a system. I know, you know, we have the law firm blueprint with Jay Ruane, king of systems. And to me, I want to be able to solve a problem that's then replicable, not just put the Band-Aid on it, but I want to know, hey, now I don't need to worry about X, Y, or Z. We had a problem on intake. We promoted. We found a rock star. We built the team. We now have the recruiting team to fill it. Again, this is not for the faint of heart, and it's not for somebody who's running a smaller size corporate transactional practice. But that said, those things, if somebody does want to scale, I think are invaluable, because the thought is, again, I'll go back to the story of starting Blue Shark. Every 2 years from the time I started Price Benowitz, I had an assistant. I would say a guy, but one time it was a woman. So I'd have a person, and to a T, every 2 years, that person would spin out and go somewhere else. Not to a competition. One would be a government contractor, one went to sports management, but they weren't with me. And every time I was like, ah, damn. And the numbers they were talking about to have retained were pretty darn high. One's well beyond, so yeah, I'll just train the next person. And when you're younger, that's fine. But as you and I have hit the middle age world, we're like, yeah, it gets a little old and tiring. So the idea that you can build something where you have the margins in order to allow for that. So once the margins are there, allowing for the long-term solution, I think goes a long, long way.
Yeah. So to kind of what piqued your curiosity besides wanting to get more cases for your law firm, why marketing? I mean, why did you go that route? What was the thing that pulled you there?
I would say that for me, I loved it. To me, it was a puzzle. Like everybody does what everybody, our spouses, ourselves, our partners, our deputies, everybody does what they love to do.
Right.
And if you try to get them to do something they hate to do, it rarely happens. So if somebody hates numbers and you try to put them in an accounting role, it's gonna crash. So if somebody said to me, I was really thoroughly mediocre at big law. Uh-huh. And to me, if I was able to, I wanted to be one of the clients. I love the fact that they could figure out how to make the phone ring, build a business, and then hire the lawyers to come in and do the paperwork, to hire you. That was my goal. My goal in starting something was, how could I hire you? And I do that now, right? We hire litigators, corporate people. We have Joel Need, who's in-house doing transactional for us. But like anything I need, I don't pretend to go to court to litigate or do ethics work. We have people for each of those things that we pay on the outside. So for me, I love the puzzle of saying, hey, if I do this, this, and this, that's going to move a website up in the Google rankings. I'm going to get the phone to ring. Or if I send out this many emails for something, or whatever it is, to me, the puzzle of adding fuel and creating a fire that gets bigger and bigger and allows you to then feed others, that drives me. And so for me, it was sort of like, I love doing it. It didn't feel like work. I got to say, when I first started, I'd sit down at night and figure out, where can I get a link on what directories are out there, legal directories in the early Google search. And every legal directory, I'd like email or call, say, hey, can I get a link? You know, and like, you know, and that was, it was like, wow, if I do this, this happens. And that was a really neat thing. And now we have such expertise as to what works and what doesn't work. It's a really cool experience because you're able to say, hey, with this money, this much resources, we're able to efficiently spend that money and deliver ROI and allow other people to build their firms. That's a really cool feeling. And like, it's very satisfying for me. It gets me up in the morning. So I feel like, you know, if you like doing something, you're likely to do it and push yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs get started for that reason, right? They see something they like, see something they love and enjoy. What type of, and these can be very high level because I know you and Jay are very much into systematizing things. What type of systems do you recommend for, you know, not just me, but any type of entrepreneur getting started? You know, what would you say is like your first thing you should do to make it, to take it to the next level?
Well, look, I think that I'm torn because like Jay loves systems. He loves talking about systems, et cetera. Right. So for me, I'm a big believer in tinkering with stuff to see what works, because before you can build a system, you have to know how to do it in the first place and how you want others to do it. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make, including myself, which is when you have a new job to do, look at yourself, you're trying to hire somebody new to do X in your office. And it's never been done before by anybody.
Right.
So the problem is you don't have a roadmap. And very often the first person fails, the second person fails, the third person works out. So once you get to the point where you know what you want done, I mean, am I right that you've had this, right?
You're 100% right on that. Yep.
Right. And rule of threes. I wish I could. And if you can't get out of bed, if you say, that's the first person I'm hiring, they're never working out. You don't go in thinking that.
Right.
But
like
generally it takes a lot in order to get that to happen. So what does that mean? I think what it means is the more, you know where I've seen it most clearly, most recently, because as I've built and grown, I'm like, okay, I'm doing recruiting. Okay. My wife says I have to go to sleep. So now I have to hire somebody else to do recruiting. And I sort of like, at first, just get it done. Make it happen. My law partner always yells at me. Don't ever say make it happen. But where I've seen it, and to answer your question most directly, where I have seen this take the most effect is as we've added international labor on. Because if you add international labor on and you don't have a clear operating procedure of what you want done, it's not going to happen. Right. So when you say, what do you need a system for? Anything that you want to scale with somebody other than yourself, you really need. And, you know, I started early on, we called it a manual, it was a Google Doc, you know, my ops people want to move this into something more elegant. But the idea is if you have something, because I'll tell you what I have done to my detriment over the years. When somebody gives notice, okay, open up your manual and fill it out, right? Rather than the best practices, which is what Jay would tell you to do, which is every day you're adding to it, you're building it out. Because I don't love systems and manuals, but the people that do love it and it works. So instead, what I'm dealing with is, you know, and that was a historic mistake because I would wait till the person gave notice. They didn't give a shit at this point. They're ready for their next gig. They're sitting there. They just want to get out the door. And they'd sit there and the next person would come and say, what's this? Because that person hadn't thought granularly. They were just thinking in retrospect. And you got some stuff out of it. Right, but the really good stuff that we got is when it's part of your DNA. And the more you make it part of your DNA, and the biggest compliment I get is when somebody says, wow, those systems are amazing. And we're getting there. You know, things like intake now is really, and it takes great leadership at the top. Very often not me. I'm not as disciplined. I have the ideas, but it takes somebody who is disciplined enough to say, no, we're not just going to run around and do stuff. Here is the list of things that need to be done. And I think that to be a great entrepreneur, it takes a balance that if you don't get those systems down, you can't scale. But if you always think in terms of, you know, everything's got to be perfect, because I know for the early days of my intake department, which is now 20 plus people, that when it was just me and a cell phone, it was easy. I did what I felt like and what I know needed to be done as you scaled. But one of the most frustrating things is we kept changing so much that we never got a great training course. And that only over time have we gotten to the scale point where we have Trainual and use other best practices to teach people, have a course here several weeks, you know, before you ever talk to a real client. And it's, you know, it sounds like a luxury, but that those are the things that allow you to scale. That if you're just saying, hey, here's a new person, have them join the team, it does not work nearly as well.
Yeah. So I like that, because that's one of the things that I've found that entrepreneurs tend to struggle with, right? Like putting it from the idea in their head to something that can scale. And something that, you know, is worth scaling, right? Like a lot of times they'll just kind of fly by the seat of their pants and then wonder why it's not working. You know, and so systematizing and like really getting granular, you're not the first, you won't be the last, but, you know, documenting systems as you go rather than waiting till the end when someone is on the way out the door, I think is important. And also like, you know, using resources accordingly, right? Like, for instance, the program called Loom, you know, where you can do screen video recordings of everything.
Absolutely.
Use that type of thing to design so that you're not... When I worked in credit unions many years ago, and we would have an ops manual, and our ops manual would have a Word document, and it was completely documented on how to do something, right? And we would go through it when we needed it. But what would happen is it would become out of date with every new software release or every new procedure that would happen. And so they would have to distribute this new list, and sometimes it was up to date and sometimes it wasn't. More times than not, it wasn't. And so it would just be super frustrating, because you're like, okay, this is not how it's supposed to work. And so now we've got the technology where not only can you avoid those types of things, but you can have a central depository. So instead of each branch having an ops manual, you have one ops manual that is, you know, updated for everyone. And you can use that instead of you update once and everybody gets it. And you can use Loom and you can use these different resources to really create a good experience for everybody. And then rather than having to worry about out-of-date procedures, you can just do that and it fixes it rather quickly. So when you talk about being a, what part of you're saying you're a mediocre big law person, not to focus on that, but what about the law didn't strike the resonance with you?
I mean, it was the actual substance of the detail oriented, you know, writing of memos and research, and, you know, it was a lot of it was form over substance. And that part, I was like, no, I want somebody else to do that. I want to be the guy. Look, I fell in love with our clients when I was on the transactional side of law. I had these amazing people that had built really cool organizations and done amazing things. And while the law provides a really good income, especially at the big law sector, it wasn't it wasn't what I wanted to be doing. And every time I saw these entrepreneurs that had been, one was doing a roll up and reselling of software under Microsoft, and the other had been in the restaurant business in New York, and then spun that into other business opportunities, and you know people who had, you know, were brokering deals for the laying of early wires to bring broadband. I remember doing deals like that, you know, or combining two companies. I'm like, I want to be part of this two company. I want to be the guy doing the paperwork that like makes sure the dots are covered. It needs to be done. It's right, a very right. important thing. And if you screw it up, it's bad and you pay a lot of money for it. But I loved the actual substantive building of the organization more than I did literally sitting in front of a computer to make sure documents reflected what needed to be done. I didn't intuitively get it well. Right. And even when it was explained to me, it didn't like stick with me in a way. But when I met with these other people and they said, hey, we're doing this and this, but we have a roadblock here. To me, I'd spend an hour with them at dinner. It was not what I was paid to do, but I spent an hour with them at dinner figuring out how to overcome those obstacles.
Right. Okay. And I think, you know, that's, you know, having committed to going to law school and enduring big law, you know, mad props for you on that one, because that's no small thing. But I think recognizing that your heart and or abilities, you know, lie elsewhere, right? Like there's so many attorneys get stuck and in the field and say, well, I've spent this much time getting it. I don't really enjoy it. I'm just going to keep trying. And I'm miserable, but it pays well, right? Like, and so, you know, learning to pivot, which is one of the things about the podcast that I like to emphasize, whether it be pivot with your company or potentially pivot without your company, right? I mean, that's really an important lesson to learn, that you're never completely trapped only unless you let yourself be, right?
Like, absolutely, right? Yeah, I pivoted more times in my life, you know, heading to law school, out of law, big law, entrepreneurial, bubble burst. Right. I actually did a stint with TV news. I wanted to be a legal correspondent. You know, I did a stint there, realized it was too many years to get good at the craft. Right. Wasn't good enough for a 28-year-old if I had done it at a much earlier age. So I was able to sort of try a bunch of stuff, you know, and, you know, early pivot out of law. My first business before hitting the U.S. law startup was something called EasyCD.com, okay. where it was basically getting music, getting the rights to music, burning it onto CDs and mailing it out to people. And I was not, as I said, I liked music, but I was not a huge music person. Right. But I got to meet people from all, you know, the big labels wouldn't give us music. So I met all the people from the rap industry, from jazz, from indie world, and really got to see like the inner workings of this world. And I loved it. Right. It was literally sitting on milk cartons and building something for nothing. Now Napster came along and knocked us out, but all the music was free and from the major labels. But, the idea that the willingness to pivot, you know, smartly, I think is something that gets you pretty far in life.
Yeah. I like that. We're getting close to, our end. So I wanted to, like, if you had to boil down one nugget, just like, what would be the one thing that you would tell an entrepreneur that's just starting, to do?
Specifically in law, I assume.
Anything like what business wisdom?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, I'm going to put the law hat on, but it's the same for everything. It's like, where are you getting your business from? Right. You're building a mousetrap, or maybe you don't have a mousetrap yet, but if you don't have business, what do you have now? Right. If you build an amazing mousetrap, business will theoretically come. But in law, I think where do you foresee it? And not that what you foresee now is going to be that end goal. Right. But having a beacon, if you're going to be in the B2C world, what is going to be your form of marketing in order to compete? And if you're in the B2B world, you know, are you going to be somebody who leverages your personal network? Are you going to take activities? I mentioned our partner, Joel Need, who runs a transactional team at Price Benowitz. you know, this is a guy that when he was at Big Law, he used to throw breakfasts. And the early form of what we're doing now with podcasts, where you bring right. people on, have a discussion, have people in the audience listening. And like, basically, the thought is, you know, if you have business, there will, you will find, as you, and you said this earlier, about, you know, if you have the business, you'll find people to do the work and you'll be able to pay them, assuming you're not in a crazy job market like today, but generally right. without, with limited exceptions, if you have the work and you have the margins, you can then pay people to do what you need to service that work.
Right.
And so it's very often a which comes first situation. You want to commit malpractice or have unhappy customers in a non-legal sense, getting work you can't do, right? Because right. there's a lot of sort of like fake it till you make it, which is always when you see these shows about like people who are sort of like, you know, if you saw the recent mini series on a fraudster in New York who was going to do this big art installation. Now, had she raised the money and then brought this in, could she have done something? Maybe, maybe not. But the line between this genius that you know how to get money in, the question is, can you balance it so that you're not so far ahead of the curve? But I think a plan and a meaningful idea of where that business is going to come from, super important. Not that getting the work done is easy or should be minimized or is nothing, but if you don't have work, you certainly can't build the machine to service it.
Right, right. I think I think a lot of times people get stuck in they think an idea is great, but then there's no market for it, right? Like, and that's a problem because if there's a widget to be sold, right? And you're trying to sell the widget, but nobody wants that widget. It doesn't matter how cool the widget is.
Well, and I'll conclude with this. That's exactly right. So at uslaw.com, lawyers didn't want to be online. They're like, why would I be online? This is stupid. I get my business from Yellow Pages or I get from referrals. I don't want to be online. And I never, the thing, an easy CD to convince people they wanted to license their music to us, it's a terrible place to be. If you're a market maker like an Uber and you change the world, frankly, by doing illegal things in order to change it, great. But generally, if you have to convince people of your business model that it's viable versus it's so much easier when it's something that they either know they need or is easily explainable.
Yeah. Warren Buffett would agree with you on that one. In fact, did you ever see the documentary WeWork?
Yes.
We Crash is what it was.
Yes, We Crash.
Yeah, yeah. That one is very much exactly like what you're saying. Like he was creating a whole new market for something that didn't need to exist, really.
I argued it both ways. Yeah. It may have needed to exist. The valuation may have been crazy.
Yeah.
There was huge demand for it. People still love it. They want. Yeah. I want to be at a WeWork all day with smart, interesting people. The question is, was it a real estate play or was it a tech play? But in and of itself, there are a lot of things of itself. It's still there. They just opened another office near us. And the demand for social working is there. But is it worth, you know, the billions of dollars that Wall Street put on it? Probably not.
Yeah, probably not. That's right.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I sincerely appreciate it. I'm sure my listeners will greatly appreciate your wisdom. If my listeners want to reach out to you for Blue Shark or for legal services, how can they find you?
I mean, look, I'm pretty easily findable online. Follow me on Facebook. I'll follow you back and we can chat there. Seth@PriceBenowitz.com or Seth@BlueSharkDigital.com. Happy to chat. As you know, I love the puzzle, whether or not we can actually do anything monetizable together. Don't really care. But if we can help you get further with what you're doing, puts a smile on my face.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you for joining me with Seth. He's amazing. And like I said, I have nothing but great things to say about him and his willingness to share knowledge and just without expectation. And so I highly recommend him. As always, if you've gotten value out of this video, don't forget to hit like and subscribe on YouTube or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from you. If you have questions, feel free to reach out. contact@thinklegalpc. Until next time, always remember to think tactically about your business. Have a great one.